Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
New Book Network's African American Studies. I am your host, Katrina Anderson, and today I am joined by Dr. Felicity Turner, author of Proving Pregnancy, Gender, Law, and Medical Knowledge in the 19th Century United States. Professor Turner is Associate Professor of History and Honors Program Coordinator at Georgia Southern University. Thank you for joining me today, Professor Turner.
And thank you very much for having me, Katrina. I'm very happy to be here.
I would like to discuss your wonderful new book, Proving Pregnancy. So can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Sure. In its simplest form, it's a history of knowledge. And more specifically, it's a history of sort of legal, medical, social, and cultural understandings of and ideas about, as the title suggests, pregnancy and childbirth, and of the female body in the 19th century United States. And beyond that, the book identifies who possessed that knowledge of female bodies and how that ownership or possession, for lack of a better word, changed over the course of the 19th century. And so I trace the shift that happens in the possession of knowledge about the female body over the course of the 19th century. And the book traces how that transformation happened. So it traces the shift, it traces how it happened, and then most importantly, it traces the significance of that shift.
Now, why did you select law and pregnancy as your topic? And how did you become interested in this topic?
Well, of course, given the current moment in the United States, it would seem a sort of very apropos topic. But I started working on this a long time ago and didn't necessarily know about sort of current circumstances that would happen in 2022, 2023. I actually came to this subject matter through a novel, namely Toni Morrison's 1987 Beloved. I grew up in Australia and I attended college there. And as an undergraduate, I enrolled in some classes on women's literature. And at that time, I didn't identify as a feminist. Far from it. I just wanted to read more books that were written by women. And the literature major was really staid, as were a lot of the literature professors. But there were some dynamo female professors who introduced me to some really incredible books written by women that I'd never heard of. And one of them was Toni Morrison's Beloved. And you have to understand that growing up in Australia at that point in time, I had done history classes at school, of course, but certainly not U.S. history. We didn't learn anything about U.S. history. It was all British history, Australian history, European history, but American history, not at all. And in fact, everything I knew about America was pretty much from the TV. And so I think there was an extraordinary power in a novelist who could reach out from the United States to this incredibly naive sort of 20-year-old. That was about the age I was then, and sort of speak to me with this story, and sort of shape my perceptions of the world, or reshape my perceptions of the world, and kind of inspire me to go on this journey to the United States and sort of pursue further questions related to this topic. And so, you know, when I originally began researching this topic, when I did make it to the United States, you know, the question that I was looking at in the archives was, to what extent was the history of Margaret Garner, upon which Toni Morrison's Beloved is based, you know, to what extent was that an isolated one? How many others were there like her? And so I went looking initially for, you know, legal narratives or legal histories or legal cases of infanticide involving enslaved people. And that's not the question I really ended up answering, but that's where I started.
Okay. And the topic, so Beloved, it inspired your interest in infanticide with Margaret Garner's case. Now, as you're doing for Proving Pregnancy, what sources are you using in your analysis?
So the sources I use, because as I mentioned, effectively legal cases, but it's not quite legal cases. What I actually use are inquests. So they're a very specific type of legal source. And these are legal records that document the cause of death or investigate the cause of death. And I focus on inquests involving the deaths of newborn infants, as these were cases where communities suspected infanticide. Investigations into infanticide were unusual, though, because they subjected the bodies of live women to discussion and examination. And if you think about this, that's odd, because in an inquest, the focus should usually be the dead body, not the live one. But as the title suggests, the inquest was the site where communities proved pregnancy. And so they discussed the signs that indicated pregnancy and childbirth. And so the kind of questions they asked: had the woman suspected of being pregnant been larger in recent months? Was she just wearing more clothes? You know, those are the kind of things. Were there signs of blood in the room where they suspected she'd given birth? Did it smell like blood? Did it taste like blood? All of those kind of things might gross us out now, but those were the questions that they asked and that they talked about in these inquests. And so these are incredibly rich sources. And so those are the sources that I ended up using. And in large part, because not every investigation into a suspected case of infanticide also made it to trial. So I used a lot of inquests where it was kind of resolved at the inquest stage and didn't move beyond that as well.
Now, you chose to omit visual sources, and you state that in your book. Can you tell the readers why you chose not to use visual sources?
Sure. So other than sort of there was sort of two images I used, by and large, made a conscious choice to omit visual sources because I wanted readers to focus on how 19th century ordinary Americans understood pregnancy. And the way in which they did so was by using the range of senses that I just sort of described: smell, taste, sound. So I didn't mention sound just then, but, you know, one of the things that was often mentioned in inquests is, you know, well, did somebody hear the baby cry? What noises was the woman who had given birth making, or alleged to have been given birth making? And so I wanted the readers to kind of really immerse themselves in those descriptions that I was giving, rather than focus on images. And so that was why I consciously chose to omit visual sources, and particularly the kind of visual sources that you might get from medical textbooks. I wanted to shift away from that focus.
And I think you did it very masterfully well in your text. It was great. You look at two distinct environments, Connecticut and North Carolina. What made you select those two states?
There was a couple of reasons for that. First and foremost, I guess, is I thought they provided a strong contrast. Connecticut's a smaller state in terms of both population and geography. And so I explain in the introduction, I explain this in the introduction to the book. It also had this sort of fairly distinct legal culture amongst the original 13 colonies and states. And it had a somewhat different trajectory in terms of the development of medicine. So, for example, what you might call the irregulars were particularly strong in that state for quite some time. So there was a particular group known as the Thompsonians, named after a doctor called Samuel Thompson. They were particularly strong in that state. But at the same time, they also had a very well-developed regular medical profession because of universities such as Yale, which had medical schools. North Carolina, in contrast, was a bigger state in terms of both demographics and geography, and it also had a much larger enslaved population, and it abolished slavery much later than Connecticut. I think Connecticut abolished slavery, I want to say, and it was either 1808 or 1818. I'd have to double check. And there was far less of an emphasis in North Carolina on what was known as irregular medicine. So basically, most physicians who practiced in North Carolina sort of followed this traditional path where they went and trained at these mid-Atlantic medical schools, and then they would return to southern communities and practice there. And in terms of practical reasons for why I selected these two states, I was living in North Carolina when I did a majority of the research, and so that made it really easy to research there.
Understandable.
And the North Carolina archives are really well organized, and you know, so it was just perfect. And in terms of Connecticut, I had to travel there, but their archives were centrally located, which meant that my research trips were fairly straightforward. Initially, when I started this project, I wanted to include a sort of Midwestern site, and I tried to include Illinois, but that ended up being really challenging because Illinois has, I think, about 8 different archival sites spread throughout the state. And the archives, within those archives, the record's really fragmentary and incomplete. And so I just kind of gave up in the end. It was really difficult.
That would seem like it would sound like, but the book that you created is fabulous, I must say. So Connecticut and North Carolina, they work very well. And then you also bring in points of contrast too. So you get like a nice context as to what's going on with 19th century women. Now in your book, you mentioned 4 key terms that readers should understand: knowledge, law, medicine, and property. Can you kind of explain what each of those are and how are they interrelated?
So that's kind of a huge question, and I'd probably say it's easier, or I recommend that folks who are really interested in kind of digging down into how I use those terms go and read the book, or at least if they're looking for a more coherent answer than the one I'm able to give right now. I think the main point I was trying to make with those 4 terms is that, as you note, first of all, they are interrelated. But also what's really important in the 19th century is that the meanings of those four terms are very fluid, so that they're very much in flux. So affixing particular definitions to them at any point in time was often difficult to do. And by the end of the 19th century, or the early 20th century, ideas and meanings related to those ideas are a lot more inflexible and rigid. And so that's really the key point I wanted to make, is that there's a shift from a fluidity and plurality of understandings to very fixed and rigid notions about those terms, at least by comparison. And a good example to illustrate that is medicine. And so at the beginning of the 19th century, medicine, or the field of healing, it's populated by a wide variety of practitioners. And those practitioners include, you know, or could include enslaved men, free Black women, Native Americans, white females, white men. Some of those women may have identified as midwives, while others may have referred to themselves as doctors or even doctresses. That was fairly common with Native Americans, for example. And some physicians, usually white, usually male, trained in medical schools, while others trained in or adopted botanic medicine or hydropathy, which is kind of a water-based therapy. And so there was a wide range of practitioners from which ordinary everyday people could choose in order to heal them. And often those choices might be restricted by cost, for example, but you know, there's this plurality of medical practitioners. By the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, that situation, or that kind of landscape, has radically transformed. And this gourmet or smorgasbord of healthcare practitioners, if you like, has disappeared. And there's this very narrow focus on privileging the expertise of particular white male physicians trained in specific medical schools, and also on prioritizing their knowledge. So, I mean, getting to like that other term, you know, at least another one of those four terms, knowledge. So, you know, that idea of, you know, medicine having this kind of plurality of options. So there's a plurality of knowledge available, and that's changed once again by the early 20th century. So you're restricted to sort of, you know, choosing one type of knowledge, and that's the knowledge that's possessed by white male physicians who've been trained in these particular types of medical schools. So, wow. So that was the kind of transition I was trying to chase.
Wow. You know, if you think about it, you know, how much change over that course of period of time to having this array to being very narrow definitions by the time you get to the 20th century as it emerges. Now, let's go back a little bit to one of those practitioners I want to talk about from the 18th century and the 19th century, midwives. They play a very important role. Can you tell us a little bit about that and give us a couple of examples and how their role changes throughout the 19th century?
So midwives are fascinating. As numerous historians have noted, you know, women, enslaved and free, played important roles as midwives in communities. They often attended difficult deliveries, you know, helped women give birth. They were privileged by women and men for a long time in lieu of physicians as experts in childbirth, pregnancy, but also more importantly, in healing more broadly. And I think that's the important thing, right? That midwives didn't just help deliver babies, they helped as healers. And so for those of us familiar with Laurel Thatcher Ulrich's Martha Ballad, some of you may be familiar with the way she played this really vital role as a healer in the community writ large, not just, you know, as a deliverer of babies. So how the role of midwives changed over the course of the 19th century is complicated, but the easiest way is to sort of say that their role becomes marginalized as obstetrics and gynecology grows into this white male-dominated field. And as medicine professionalized, physicians sort of set in place these kind of gatekeeping functions that limit the role and significance of midwives within local communities. In terms of the kind of examples of different midwives who I focus on, particularly in the early stages, one example that I use is from, I want to say, sort of the early 19th century, 1811. I think her name is, it's either Rebecca or Judah Hall. And she's involved in a case in Caswell County in North Carolina. And they suspect a white woman of, you know, having been pregnant and having committed infanticide. And so what the midwife does in this case is she, along with another respected white woman in the community, as they kind of shuffle this suspect, her name's Elizabeth Beaver, out of the room, so away from the jury of inquest, which is a jury that is made up of white men. And so these two women, one of whom is a midwife, one of whom is a respected member of the community, they go and sort of physically examine her body. They kind of squeeze her breasts and they ask her these questions. And the purpose of these midwives in these investigations was to determine if they had, you know, if the accused women had delivered babies in these instances. And so that was kind of the role they fulfilled.
And that changes. That drastically changes as we move throughout the course. By the time we hit to the late 19th into the 20th century, their role has greatly diminished in terms of their importance. And you're also, in your book, you mentioned that there are also free Blacks, enslaved women who also come to the inquest and present testimony as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So basically, the inquests are different forms to criminal cases. So that's something to keep in mind. An inquest is basically, another word for it is simply an inquisition or an examination. So the rules of evidence that apply in criminal cases that prohibit African Americans and enslaved people from testifying against whites don't apply in relation to inquests. And I'm certainly not the first historian to note this. And so at an inquest, anyone who has knowledge of the events that have occurred has the authority to testify. And so it doesn't matter if that person is enslaved. It doesn't matter if they're free Black. It doesn't matter if they're a child. So in some cases, there are young children who are able to, you know, speak about what they've seen adult women doing. All of those witnesses are able to provide evidence or testify in the form of an inquest, because an inquest happens pretty much the day that a dead body is discovered. So a corpse is found in a field, then everybody, you know, as I say, you know, the farmers down their tools and they gather right where that body's lying, or they move the body to the nearest tavern and they, you know, they sort of hold the inquest there. And this is something that the entire community goes to. So it's a community event because everybody in the community is invested in finding out what happened.
Wow, it's just so amazing thinking about that now as we live in 2022 and you think about, okay, this is that, you know, it was a very, very important event that happened in the community that brought in all the players. And as you mentioned, the children, you could have siblings or even, let's say, a potential person's child would have to, you know, provide information as to what they saw. And that's so amazing that, and you do it masterfully, how that has shifted by the time you're getting closer to the 20th century, how much of that has changed in so many ways. And that kind of brings me back to two very important individuals. And as you were saying, when you wrote this book, you had no idea that events would happen in 2021 into 22, and now going into 23, the Beck brothers. And for both of us, the audience who do not know who they are, they actually, one brother actually provided a very, very useful distinction that is still with us today. As we talk about this notion of abortion versus infant murder distinction. Can you speak a little bit about that, Professor Turner?
Okay, so this is the Beck brothers. So who are the Beck brothers? The two men, John and Theodoric Beck. Theodoric is the older one, John is the younger one, and they're hugely important in 19th century medicine in terms of shaping this field known as medico-legal jurisprudence. And John Beck in particular, he publishes a chapter in a larger treatise that his older brother authors that relates to abortion and infanticide. So the broader text is known as Elements of Medical Jurisprudence, and it's, I think, initially published in 1823, and it goes through numerous and numerous and numerous editions, and it's circulated widely throughout the United States. But even more importantly, it extends, or its influence extends beyond the United States. I mean, it's well known in European circles as well. And John Beck contributes to it, this chapter on abortion and infanticide, because that's what he did his research on at medical school. He wrote his dissertation about this topic. And why this is important is because if you look at the layout of this document, what you see is that of this dissertation, about 90 pages are devoted to infanticide and 10 pages are devoted to abortion. And, you know, John Beck didn't think this was terribly important in the whole scheme of things. So as a physician in the early sort of 1820s, abortion's not something with which he or other physicians were necessarily greatly concerned. They're far more concerned with questions of, well, how do you prove infanticide? And then of the section that's related to infanticide, most of that is related to, well, how do you prove if the child was born dead or not? How do you prove if the fetus was born, you know, alive or not? How do you prove if it actually drew breath? And so once again, what I found important about this dissertation is the lack of interest, if you like, in women's bodies. They were far more concerned with the corpse. And so that's a big distinction between events today, I think. I mean, today that they're still kind of asking those same questions, but there seems to be a lot more focus, if you like, with regulating women's bodies. Whereas back in the 1820s, far less of a focus on that. And this is consistent with what it was like at inquests. If doctors did attend inquests, which they did at the invitation of the jury of inquest, they weren't there to look at women's bodies. I mean, that's what midwives did. Doctors were there to look at the corpse of the infant and to make sort of decisions about that.
Wow. And, you know, and going off of what you just said, we're talking pre-Civil War, because this does change over time, but you have the lawyers versus the doctors in the court system. And you're trying to, and it plays out very interestingly, because you've got kind of like this power play going on between the two entities as to who has more in the courtroom. Can you speak a little bit about that, how that happens pre-Civil War? And then we'll get into a little bit later on how that changes by the time we get to the end of the 19th century.
Sure. Well, what I would actually say is it's possibly even, I would probably tease it out a little more than that and say that what the real battle is prior to the Civil War is that Physicians are really kind of battling other healers. So they're battling with the authority of midwives, for example. And so because physicians are circulating in this universe prior to the Civil War, where there's a range of healers available to people and midwives are held in such high authority and such high esteem, they lack credibility in the courtroom. Okay. And so midwives, for example, their word may be more valued by lawyers than that of a physician. So women hold greater authority than men in those environments because they know more about pregnancy and childbirth. And so this is the problem that physicians face in this pre-Civil War period.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Wow. So it was that during this period, as we're seeing, that women possess, or at least the appearance given their experience during this time, because you don't have this medical profession that's established, women's knowledge oftentimes trumped in many cases the medical practitioner's knowledge, say a doctor during this period, especially in an inquest early on.
Yeah, definitely. And that was definitely the case. So women were considered the experts. And so, yeah, they could easily speak out and sort of say, well, you know, we're the ones that, or our opinion is that, you know, either she has or she has not given birth to a child, and or the baby was or was not born dead. So physicians were consulted, but they were not considered experts. And so that will change over time.
Right. And this is also, as I'm thinking, as you're saying, that this is related to who has access to the women's bodies, especially during this time, because as you mentioned, the doctors, they're more interested in the corpse, whereas the midwives, they're the ones who are looking at the women's bodies during this period.
Yes, though I think this is something that you and I discussed prior to the interview. This is complicated by race.
Yes.
So yeah, so that's definitely complicated by race. So the main thing to sort of keep in mind during this period, this sort of pre-Civil War period, is that in terms of white women's bodies, it's mostly women who have access to those bodies, though wealthier women are beginning to invite doctors, professionally trained physicians, into their birthing rooms if they think those doctors can help. And that's happening, or more likely to be happening, in urban areas, you know, in places like Philadelphia, where doctors are more common. So that's beginning to change. But I mean, that environment there is, you know, where women have the power to choose to invite men into the birthing room. But in the kind of cases I look at where women usually do not have much choice, white women are being inspected by white midwives usually. In the case of African-American women, it varies. Sometimes they're examined by enslaved midwives or free black midwives, sometimes by white physicians. It really depends upon the owner and what the court system or what the local community really wants to do. But yes, so it's definitely complicated by race. And certainly for enslaved women, they have no choice about who looks at their body. Free black women, usually it's other black women, usually not so much white physicians.
Right. Now, we are talking about pre-Civil War America during this period, and this kind of goes back to what inspired this whole journey for you coming to the United States, the case of Margaret Garner, who inspired Toni Morrison's Beloved, that kind of started your own inquest. Can you tell us a little bit how that has been used by both anti-slavery advocates and pro-slavery advocates? You have this, I want to say, this mythos that's been created around that image during the 19th century.
Sure. And I mean, it's, you know, of the two images I do actually use in the book, one of them is of this very powerful image of Margaret Garner, precisely because it kind of frames a lot of what we think about infanticide in the 19th century. And so both the abolitionist movement, so that's the anti-slavery movement, and the pro-slavery movement use the rhetoric of infanticide to try and advance their causes. And so for those of you those listeners who are not familiar with the story of Margaret Garner, she was an enslaved woman in 1856. She escaped from slavery in Kentucky to Ohio, and she killed one child and attempted to slit the throat of another. I think, if memory serves, I've kind of got the details right there.
Yes, you do.
Okay, good. Thank you, Katrina. I was like, I think I've got them all right there. And so basically, you know, the argument that abolitionists made was, you know, that they took this case and they sort of said, oh, you know, this highlights perfectly the tragedy of slavery, that this enslaved mother would rather kill her child or children than have them grow up in slavery. And it proved, and I use that word in quotation marks, you know, what they had been, what abolitionists, many, you know, most of whom were white, had been trying to say all along. And so within this kind of framework or within this argument, abolitionists characterized slavery as a disease that was infecting the nation. And infanticide was just one of the many manifestations of that disease. And the case of Margaret Garner, following that logic, proved that infanticide was a disease, and so once slavery had been rooted out, the idea was then infanticide would disappear. And so whatever their intention was, I mean, you know, obviously this argument served useful purposes in terms of sort of, you know, trying to say, you know, slavery is bad, you know, this is kind of the things that will prompt enslaved mothers to do. It also sets in motion a sort of complicated and damaging series of ideas that tended to racialize infanticide, and that would persist long after the Civil War. Now, at the same time that anti-slavery advocates making those arguments, pro-slavery supporters were arguing that infanticide was widespread, that it wasn't related to slavery, and that it was a disease of capitalism. And so they argued that slavery, because it kept, you know, in their view, I want to emphasize, enslaved people kind of well-fed and housed, it actually limited infanticide, that there would be more infanticide if not for the benefits, the so-called benefits of slavery. And so this argument too would prove problematic because it was setting up a dynamic that pro-slavery supporters could and did use after emancipation, or freedom, to demonstrate exactly why, in their minds, African Americans were not worthy of freedom. And so I'm happy to talk more about those ideas, but they do play out. They kind of set these arguments up without perhaps realizing they're setting them up. And then, yeah, they play out.
And I have to say, Professor Turner, some of them unfortunately still persist today.
Yes.
I think on the abolitionist part, it wasn't their intent to do this. And I know from my own research, the idea and the mythos around Margaret Garner, it went international during the 19th century. But yes, as you were saying, as freedom changed things post-Civil War, ideas about Blackness and motherhood are largely influenced by those images. So can you speak to how this idea, after emancipation, this idea about how infanticide in some ways became tied to the former enslaved population, these notions of Blackness and what that meant, and how that's ideas about Black mothers during this time that were used post-emancipation?
So both camps have basically, and by both camps, I mean the sort of abolitionists and the pro-slavery people, they have sort of established this pre-existing rhetoric prior to the Civil War that linked race to infanticide. And so when slavery is eliminated, this rhetoric kind of transforms and sort of simply slips into place. So for anti-slavery activists, what happens all of a sudden is that it wasn't that infanticide was a disease or a product of slavery. It's like, oh, well, actually, infanticide was a product of Blackness. So slavery's gone, but they now just connect it to Blackness, and particularly to mothering. And there's some particularly problematic literature that they circulate that kind of elaborates on these points where they sort of talk about mothering, you know, they kind of give African-American, you know, newly freed African-American mothers, for example, sort of lessons in mothering and focus on sort of cleanliness and ideas about this, you know, all of which kind of reinforce ideas that African-American mothers are bad mothers and have to be taught to be good mothers now that they're free. Now, these ideas dovetail with pro-slavery arguments that, you know, absent slavery, Black mothers would prove incapable of looking after their children, which is what, you know, pro-slavery supporters have believed all along. And so these arguments kind of coalesce during emancipation. And they make it very difficult for Black mothers who are trying to survive in a challenging environment after slavery, you know, in terms of finding jobs, keeping their families together, and at the same time they're trying to exist in an environment where people around the nation, white people around the nation, are basically saying, well, you're just bad mothers.
Right. And you're starting to see this play out in the court system as well, because you've got this differentiation that you mentioned of how Black and white women's crimes are viewed, both who've committed infanticide during this period. And this also dovetails into punishment and who gets punished and who does not. And all of this is occurring right as after emancipation, all of this is happening.
Definitely. Definitely see it occurring, sort of playing out in the court system. There's a changing nature of punishments for a whole series of reasons. Basically, I mean, the short version is that Black women generally serve longer sentences, generally found themselves serving longer sentences during this period than white women. And part of, you know, the reasons for this are complicated, but, you know, sort of thinking of a couple of examples, you know, there's a woman, Frances Hood from North Carolina, and she's fairly late. She's about 1880. And then another woman, Mary Davis from Connecticut. Both of these are examples of women who were charged with infanticide or child abandonment, sort of, you know, child neglect. And in both instances, these were African-American women. They served lengthy prison terms, which when compared to most white women who were convicted of the same or similar crimes during this period, you know, these sentences were much longer than they generally were as well than they would have been prior to the Civil War. And this is in part because there's an increased focus on incarcerating Black bodies in this era of freedom. And this is particularly pronounced in the South.
Right, because and that gets back to that basic question of as to who owns that body, especially now post-emancipation when there was, quote unquote, an owner, but now it's free, but yet it's still not free. And they do not want to give them ownership of their bodies during this time. And I just, it, you know, as I'm thinking about this, as we're talking, you know, there's different excuses, whereas during this time you will have a white woman who's committed infanticide, and I think maybe it's related to class too here, that may be, oh, there's an excuse, she's more of a victim, whereas with the Black mother, there's this idea of inherent guilt, there's something wrong with her for committing the same crime. You know, you see this starting to play out, especially in the media, especially in the narratives that are going on in the 19th century newspapers as these crimes are being posted and written about, which is definitely helping to shape opinion about who should or should not, who has guilt and who does not, and who should suffer those punishments during this period.
Oh, definitely. I would agree. And I mean, the newspapers are fascinating to read because you will find reports. In fact, I did find reports about infanticide committed by a white woman and a Black woman on the same page of a newspaper. And, you know, these women are described in different ways, or the crime is described in different ways. So first of all, at a basic level, white women are never identified as white. The race is not stated, but non-white people race, or non-white women, the race was always stated. And, you know, and their crime was, you know, the kind of adjective that was used was a horrifying crime, or, you know, sort of disgusting crime. Whereas a report of infanticide involving a white woman tended to be simply factual, if you like, a dead baby discovered in a field. And so these were the kind of contrasts that you would find in terms of newspaper reporting. So one type of reporting was intended to horrify and sort of create this image or reinforce this image that Black people were in some way something to be frightened of, whereas the other one was sort of to downplay any threat that might have been represented by whiteness.
Right. And all of this, you've got emancipation, you've got this ideas about Blackness that are circulating during this period. All of this is happening at the same time that you're having the professionalization of medicine. So you have yet another layer that's adding into the mix of this picture and this narrative that's being created. And you mentioned this term, and you spoke about it a little bit earlier, the regulars. And so you're starting to get the medical professionals are becoming, it's definitely becoming a field now at the same time as all of this is happening. And this is also going to shape the narrative of what's going on with Black and white women during this period.
Sure. It's definitely becoming a lot more of a field. And so there's a lot of debate within the history of medicine and the history of healthcare about the use of sort of these two opposing terms, the regulars versus the irregulars, but it's kind of hard not to fall into using these terms, although they're problematic. But basically, the regulars were, and still are, if you like, the physicians who ended up defining what the parameters of medicine should be, and in many ways still are today. And so that was, you had to be licensed, you know, you should be a member of the, and by license, I mean licensed with a state medical board, should be a member of the American Medical Association, had to attend a certain type of medical school with certain types of training. And so what will happen in the early 20th century, I don't talk about this in my book, which finishes up about 1880, but in the early 20th century, they basically go ahead through this particular process and close down a whole bunch of medical schools for African Americans, for women, for Jewish doctors. When they're talking about particular types of medical schools, you can see how they're sort of narrowly defining that. And successfully restricted sort of surgical privileges in hospitals to people who meet these conditions. And so these are the kind of physicians that they're defining as the regulars. And the reason that they're doing this is they're making it more and more difficult for the irregulars, so those who don't meet those conditions, to practice medicine. And so this is all happening at that time. What they're also doing in concert with this is basically more vigorously prosecuting people who represent themselves as physicians, or who represent themselves as physicians but don't meet these parameters. And so they begin to do that as well. And so they're becoming really clear about sort of defining what this professional, what a professional physician looks like.
Right. And women are now, some of them, and this is, they're shifted into more of the nursing role because it's distinctive, more feminine. And it's also, it's very interesting that even for, and it's kind of in some ways, I would say, modeled along with upper class white women who are starting to seek out male professionals at this time. Doctors, they're the ones that they are going to, which is also lessening the role of women over the course of the 19th century. They're seeking out more what you would call the regulars to be the ones as their medical practitioners during this period as well.
Certainly. So, yes. So I would say that there's sort of this there's a whole lot of complicated processes going on. So I would certainly say that white middle and upper class women are certainly seeking out sort of physicians, those kind of physicians to be their doctors. And then other women in terms of jobs or roles are moving into nursing rather than trying to sort of move into being doctors. Part of the reason that some women are going to doctors, or these women, these upper class women are going to physicians, for the kinds of reasons that historian Shannon Withycombe talks about in her book about miscarriage, is they hope that these physicians, for example, can help them with things like miscarriages and the suffering and kind of grief over that. So those are the kind of reasons that those women choose to go to those kind of doctors. But for the kind of women, once again, that I write about, for whom there's a lot less choice, this kind of professionalization is problematic. They don't really have so much choice. They find themselves having to be examined by these white male medical doctors, for example.
Wow. And what's interesting is it's no longer, by the time we get to the end of your book, sadly, it's no longer just their bodies that they want to control at this time. They're also starting to delve more into their mental capacities. And that's also tied to race during this period. So can you speak a little bit about that?
Sure. So what I would say is, because men are active, the medical profession, which is by now sort of dominated by men, is actively working to restrict female access to that medical profession. One of the things that they're doing is sort of saying, well, women don't really have the mental capacity to practice as physicians. And in part, the reason for that is because they have a uterus, and that prompts them to act in ways that are slightly deranged every month, this sort of hysterical every month. And this makes them less mentally capable of being a physician. And so these are the kind of reasons that they give for excluding women from the practice of medicine.
And it's so interesting that you still kind of somewhat, even though it's definitely to a lesser state now, but you still kind of have this mythos that goes on about this image of what happens to women and their mental capacities. Because you kind of have this idea, and I think about it kind of like the PMS. There's this idea, that if a woman is kind of like over emotional, kind of like upset, but you kind of are beginning to see these ideas formulate in the latter half of the 19th century, something that we just kind of take for granted now.
Yes, but it's also complicated because middle and upper class white women, they lean into these ideas, for lack of a better term. I don't necessarily like that phrasing, but they deploy those narratives at the same time to try and get out of being responsible in cases of infanticide. So they're able to, these middle and upper class white women, they're able to say, oh, well, I was suffering from insanity at the time of, at the time of childbirth. So that's why I murdered my child. And so they'll get a doctor or two to testify on their behalf and say, well, yes, women do suffer from insanity at the, what they called it was puerperal insanity at the time of childbirth. And yes, it's highly probable this woman was. And so therefore they're able to, they're able to get off if the case goes to trial. But African-American women are unable to use that as a defense because insanity is in some way related to, or sanity, insanity, it's related to civilization or the level of civilization that is purported to exist in society. And it is assumed that African Americans are naturally less civilized anyway. And so therefore, the logic goes, they are unable to make the claim that they were insane when they did it. And so they can argue that, or arguments that are made on their behalf, is that they are less intelligent. And so that might get a reduction in sentence for them. But white women, in contrast, will escape jail time completely. But African-American women still have to serve some sentence. And so once again, we see race and class complicating these kind of arguments in these cases.
Well, and it's so interesting how it shifts from the late 18th, early 19th century till we get to by the time after the Civil War, how much has changed in your book. Now, What would you say you would want readers to take away from the book? Is there anything in particular that you would want them to take away?
No,
lot that I did, I can say. So
that's a great question. I should probably ask you what you take away from the book. But I want to say that the argument I make in the conclusion is that one of the enduring legacies of sort of middle and upper class white feminism in the 19th century is that they didn't realize the value of the property or the value of what they possessed in terms of knowledge about the female body at the time, at the beginning of the 19th century. And they became so focused on a different type of property, basically kind of gaining voting rights, owning the kind of property that was owned by wealthy white men, that they overlooked the fact that they were kind of losing control of this knowledge that they already owned or possessed, if you liked. Knowledge of the female body. And so part of the reason I make that point in the conclusion is I want to encourage readers to rethink historical narratives of progress about women's rights, what rights look like, and to sort of rethink how we, you know, what the history of the 19th century might look like if we retell it through that different lens.
And I will say you did that actually very masterfully in your book. It definitely opened my eyes in many ways as to how, and you're correct, knowledge is power. And women, you know, from the late 18th century into the 19th century, they had quite a bit. And as you mentioned, they did not know how much they possessed at that time. As they say, hindsight is 20/20. But, you know, if you could kind of go back in time and see that, it would be interesting to say how would that narrative have shifted historically with that information.
Thank you. I'm so glad that you were able to take that away from the book, because that was really one of the things that I wanted readers to take away.
It was great. I want readers to go out and pick up Professor Turner's Proving Pregnancy, Gender, Law, and Medical Knowledge in the 19th Century United States. It is a must read, I would say, for undergraduates and graduate students. There's so much that you are able to take away from this book and learn, especially about issues of race and gender in the 19th century. During this period. Thank you, Professor Turner, for joining me today to share your knowledge with us about your amazing book. And I really want readers to go out and grab this book today. It is, I will say, this is a book that you must read to learn more about issues of women, body, the medical profession. There is a lot there for everyone. So thank you for joining me, Professor Turner.
Well, thank you, Katrina, for that enthusiastic endorsement and huge encouragement for all your readers. This has been great fun, and it's been an enormous pleasure discussing the book with you. And thanks again very much to you and to the listeners and to the New Book Network.
Thank you, Professor Turner.